I'm Gail Harris in for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
19 bishops who voted in yesterday's historic election in the Episcopal Church are protesting the outcome. Anglican bishops voted 62-45 to elevate the Reverend Gene Robinson to bishop, making him the first openly gay bishop in the church's long history. The dissenting bishops declared a pastoral emergency and asked God to have mercy on the church. Here's part of the statement read by Pittsburgh Bishop Robert Duncan.
This body has divided itself from millions of Anglican Christians around the world, brothers and sisters who have pleaded with us to maintain the church's traditional teaching on marriage and sexuality.
Pittsburgh Bishop Robert Duncan representing 19 other bishops protesting yesterday's vote. Well, joining us on the line from the ongoing Minneapolis Episcopal Church Convention is the Boston Globe's religion reporter Michael Paulson. Michael, hello.
Hi.
And first of all, Bishop Duncan of Pittsburgh seems to have a grim analysis of the future of the church, and there have been statements of condemnation from Malaysia, from South Africa. Is there going to be a schism in the Episcopal Church?
Well, that remains to be seen, but there's no question that for bishops outside of the United States and for conservatives here in the U.S., what took place yesterday in confirming an openly gay bishop is a fiasco and is cause for division within the Anglican Communion. Mm-hmm. The Archbishop of Canterbury, who's the head of this church, did put out a statement last night urging people to take a deep breath before doing anything that would permanently change the makeup of this denomination. He's acknowledged that this is a very large step that has repercussions on the Anglican Communion that even he cannot predict.
Yeah. Bishop Duncan asked the Archbishop and other higher-ups to intervene in the pastoral emergency. Is there likely to be more intervention than just that comment?
I think ultimately there will be some kind of gathering of the primates, who are the presiding bishops of the various Anglican provinces around the world, and they'll have to decide how to proceed. Some of the conservative Episcopalians here in the U.S. have suggested that there should be a separate kind of more orthodox Episcopal province in the U.S. that is distinct from the Episcopal Church of the U.S. as we now know it.
Well, Michael, the Reverend Robinson was cleared of all allegations against him, and once they came to light, they seemed insignificant to most people. He was accused of touching a man on his shoulder and arm twice while talking to him. He was also affiliated with a group 5 years ago that now has a website, and several layers into that website, it had links to graphic material, which, in fact, just about all websites do. So both of these charges were dismissed. Has that left a bad feeling with some of the bishops that this might have been part of a smear campaign?
Absolutely. Some of the more liberal bishops and lay people and clergy here suspect that the timing of these allegations was not coincidental. But as you say, both allegations were dismissed out of hand after a very brief investigation. The allegation of harassment turned out to involve a kind of level of touching that most people would consider minor. Mm. And the website, Gene Robinson, had nothing to do with the organization by the time they established a website.
One last question, Michael. In your paper, The Boston Globe, there's a chart that shows the other religions the Episcopal Church joins in allowing openly gay clergy. They include Unitarian Universalist, United Church of Christ, Quakers, Presbyterians, the Jewish faith, Reform, and the Catholic Church.
Well, I guess we should be clear that some of those denominations allow gay clergy so long as they're celibate. The Catholic Church allows any Catholic man who passes scrutiny at a seminary to become a priest as long as he promises to be celibate.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Paulson is the religion reporter for the Boston Globe.
Attorney General John Ashcroft has taken another step in his battle with federal judges over sentencing guidelines. In a memo issued last week, Ashcroft instructs government prosecutors to report judges who hand down lenient sentences and to launch more appeals against sentences they don't like. The move had been widely expected. It's a Justice Department effort to enforce a new law known as the Feeney Amendment. That amendment was designed to force judges to impose sentences along federal guidelines or explain in writing why they hadn't. The Feeney Amendment has been blasted by a number of federal judges and Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and at least one federal judge has announced he'll resign over these new restrictions. Another critic, Judge Nancy Gertner of the U.S. District Court in Massachusetts, joins us now. Judge Gertner, welcome.
Hello.
Judge, what do you make of this memo from the Attorney General instructing U.S. attorneys who prosecute these cases to report judges who give out what they're saying are soft sentences?
Well, first of all, the notion of soft sentences needs to be addressed. Whatever Attorney General Ashcroft has said, it was clear that the vast majority of judges in most cases followed the guidelines, but we recognize that guidelines could not possibly fit individual cases, nor could everyone think in advance of the kinds of issues that would come up down the line. What is disingenuous about this is that the prosecutors always were supposed to appeal when a judge did something which they believed to be wrong. So this is really symbolic, I think, and very troubling.
Can you give us an example of a case in which a judge's discretion would be important?
Yes. I've departed downward in cases of battered women.
Well, couldn't it be argued that in this case the Attorney General is simply doing his job? He's enforcing a law that Congress has passed.
Well, it's a little bit more troubling than that. On the one hand, he's doing what he should have been doing all along. But if there were concerns about particular guideline departures, they should have brought those concerns to the Sentencing Commission. Hey, judges are departing on this ground. Is it because there's something really wrong, or are they wrong, and in which case change the guidelines? Rather than doing it that way, he is essentially grandstanding, in my judgment.
Why is it, then, do you think, that some states, including Massachusetts, where you sit, do tend to issue sentences that depart from these guidelines more than others?
You know, I've actually done a study in my jurisdiction of why we depart. And what I've discovered is this. First of all, the departures in my jurisdiction, the overwhelming departures are under 2 years. Now, you understand that we frequently sentence federal offenders to 10 and 15 years. So you're talking about minor adjustments on already quite substantial sentences. And so the notion of lenient judges is preposterous. I think the public has to understand that what we are doing is mitigating the harsh effects of the guidelines. We're individualizing it. Congress can set the broad parameters of sentencing, but we deal with individual human beings. What we do is on the record, and it's subject to appeal. The extraordinary thing about this is that what the prosecutors do is not on the record, is not public, and is not subject to appeal. And the further we walk down this road, the more the actions of people like Attorney General Ashcroft will remain unexamined. You know, why particular charges are brought against particular individuals? Why do you go to particular courts rather than any other? We are getting to the point where we are adequately controlling judges who are the most accountable of all rather than prosecutors who are the least.
Judge Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Nancy Gertner sits on the federal bench in the District Court of Massachusetts. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last year that juries in state courts, not judges, must decide whether to apply the death sentence in capital cases. When that ruling was passed, some defense lawyers breathed a sigh of relief, assuming that juries would be more lenient than judges. But the opposite has happened in Arizona, where death sentences have jumped from 17% to 83%. That trend was reported in today's Wall Street Journal by Robert Greenberger, who joins us on the line now from Washington. Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
Big surprise here, certainly in Arizona?
Very much so in Arizona. As you say, the numbers are a dramatic turnabout from what they had been the year before. Nobody's quite sure why this is happening, and it's a relatively new way of doing things, and some people are saying it'll smooth itself out over time, but other people are saying maybe it won't. Maybe juries either in Arizona or in general are taking a different view towards this issue.
And how do you account for that huge increase?
Well, basically, what happened was after the Supreme Court decision, the state of Arizona's legislature passed a law, and one of the things that changed was that the time between the part of a murder trial, which is known as the guilt phase, where a person is pronounced guilty, and the second phase, during which the defense lawyer has an opportunity to plead on behalf of his or her client, was compressed. In Arizona, when judges were doing this, sometimes several months would go by, so defense lawyers had plenty of time to prepare for this second phase. Now, all of a sudden, it comes immediately. Now, this sounds very procedural, but the important thing is that defense lawyers have been caught off guard and have not had time to prepare for this. So one possibility is that they're just not gathering enough information quickly enough to adequately defend their clients.
And perhaps we should explain, Robert, that this new ruling really only affects about a handful of states, right?
That's exactly right, yes. There are 38 states that have the death penalty. Of those, only five states were directly affected by this ruling. Those are Arizona, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, and Nebraska. Four other states have a hybrid system, a little bit of the judge, a little bit of the jury, and there's a possibility that they may be affected, but that's going to play out in the court system over the next couple of years.
Hmm. And one of the public defenders that you quote in the article said that he had thought it was a good idea because he felt that juries brought a citizen's perspective to these decisions. What evidence is there that that perspective is different? I mean, is this saying to us that juries are actually much tougher than judges?
You know, one of the things I learned reporting this story is that it really depends who you talk to. It seems to be a mixed bag. On the one hand, juries can be tougher because in most instances it's the first time that they've been exposed to the details of a murder trial, and if they find it particularly ghastly, they may be more inclined to order somebody put to death. On the other hand, juries are not as professional and seasoned as judges, of course, and other people say they would shy away from the death penalty, putting another human being to death. So what I discovered was the more defense attorneys and others I spoke to, that people were on both sides of this issue.
Hmm. And what impact do you think this might have on the appeal process? Because that's fairly lengthy as it is.
Yes, I think it's going to greatly increase that length of the appeal process, because a lot of these cases that are going through now, let's take Arizona, the dozen or so cases that are going through there, I am certain that the defendants are going to say that they were not adequately represented and use that as a basis for an appeal. So I spoke to a judge out there who's convinced that this could add as much as 6 to 8 years to the process of going from indicting somebody to the completion of the legal process.
Well, Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Greenberger is a writer and reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
This note, Eagle County, Colorado sheriff's deputies spent yesterday shuttling between the airport and the courthouse in a mock motorcade that included two residents standing in for basketball star and accused rapist Kobe Bryant and his wife. The two are expected to arrive at 4 this afternoon at the courthouse in Eagle, which will then empty of workers so that everyone can come back in and pass through the county's only metal detector. Bryant has said he is guilty of adultery, but not of the charges of rape lodged against him by a 19-year-old local woman. His appearance today is expected to last no more than 10 minutes, the entire Colorado visit less than an hour. But a trial appears inevitable, and the residents of Eagle, population 3,500, are bracing for a long August.
Just ahead, Roy Blunt Jr.'s new book on Robert E. Lee sheds light on the Civil War figure seen by some as a defender of slavery and others as the standard bearer of Southern pride.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Robert E. Lee is a name that summons different images depending on what part of the country. Hero, 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 symbol of slavery in the North. But General Lee was considerably more complicated than that. He was Abraham Lincoln's first choice to lead the Union troops, but Lee's devotion to his native state of Virginia caused him to side, somewhat reluctantly, with the Confederacy.
I accept the position assigned me by your partiality. I would have much preferred had your choice fallen on an abler man. But trusting to Almighty God, an approving conscience, and the aid of my fellow citizens, I devote myself to the service of my native state, in whose behalf alone will I ever again draw my sword.
That's Robert Duvall as Robert E. Lee in the Civil War epic Gods and Generals, declaring himself for a cause he had grave doubts about. That internal conflict is one reason why Southern writer and humorist Roy Blunt, Jr. decided to turn his attention from writing about Mark Twain to writing about another American icon. His new biography is called, simply, Robert E. Lee. Today we begin a two-part conversation with Roy Blunt about the general and the ways in which Lee's life is viewed.
Well, the view from about his death in 1870 till, I don't know, till, say, the Civil Rights Movement was that he was this great unifying figure who had been a purely honorable man and had done the best for his part of the country and had then stood in favor of reconciliation between the North and the South. And however, gradually that view has begun to sort of separate into two views, one of which continues to think of him as an icon of honor and dignity, and the other view tends to take him as an icon of slavery and treason. So he's, whereas he had been a unifying figure, he is now a divisive figure.
You also describe Robert as a bit of a stick. How so, and what do you think made him that way?
Well, yeah, it was hard for me to cozy up to Robert because he tended to be awfully pious. And distant. People said no one knew him, you know, and people say that about a lot of great men, but it really seemed to apply to him. He was always heavily into self-denial, which meant that he didn't express his own interests or feelings very much. And, you know, he tried to make himself better than human to make up for his father, and because his mother, he had seen his mother suffer from his father's profligacy, and so and Robert always had to be a perfect son to the mother, and he went on being a perfect icon to all sorts of people.
And it's interesting, though, because at the same time he described himself as being filled with confusion and despair about whether he had been able to accomplish anything good in his life. It makes you wonder why he was so hard on himself.
You hate to invoke terms like self-esteem with regard to people like Robert E. Lee, but in fact his self-esteem was really low. He was always talking about what a miserable wretch he was, and he was always putting himself into God's hands. And then, but instead of feeling good about having faith in God's will, it just made him feel worse about how he wasn't living up to God's will. I mean, he tended to kind of spread that gloom onto his children and his wife. However, many other people said that he was one of the funniest men they knew. I mean, that's not uncommon for people who have a sense of humor to also have great capacities for gloom and self-loathing. He certainly did.
Sure. Well, Twain, as you say, is certainly a good illustration of that as well. Roy, what do you see as the case for his views on slavery? Was he as anti-slavery as he's often been portrayed, because he did, in fact, own slaves?
Yeah, the notion that he was against slavery rests entirely on his a letter he wrote to his wife. But he certainly didn't argue against slavery, so far as we know. He was not much of an arguer. But up in the northern aristocratic South, it was a common thing to talk about what an evil slavery was, but to go on having slaves. Now, Lee, since he was in the Army, didn't depend on slave labor, but he inherited some slaves from his father-in-law, or at least his family did. When his father-in-law died at the beginning of, or just before the war broke out, it fell to Lee to fulfill the father's will. One other thing aristocratic slave owners tended to do was to have the use of slaves all their lives, and then have it in their will that their heirs should free the slaves within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So while Lee was fighting for the slave system during the war. He was groaning and worrying about all the legal details he had to go through to emancipate this handful of slaves.
And, of course, the other big contradiction in his life, here was a man who had been in the U.S. Army, held a commission for 32 years. How difficult was it for him to go to war against the Union that he had served?
Well, that's his big decision was to stay in the Union Army, where he could have commanded the Union troops in the field against the Confederacy, or to go with the Confederacy. He didn't believe in secession. There again, lots of gentlemen of the South were anti-secession, but as soon as it looked like war, and as soon as the majority of the Southern states seceded, they all fell into line and all were ready to fight. But he didn't want to fight, and he didn't want to secede, but it was his duty, he felt, to defend Virginia. He was a Virginian before he was an American. Lee and Lee's ancestors had always been Virginians, and his wife was a Virginian. If he'd stayed with the Union, his wife would never have forgiven him. So he stayed with the people who were closest to him and fought for them, even though he probably knew they couldn't win.
Roy Blunt, Jr. is author of a new biography on Robert E. Lee. The book is part of the Penguin Live series. Tomorrow, we conclude our conversation with Roy as we explore the general's leadership on the battlefield.
There tends to be a consensus that Lee was a great defensive general, and on offense, he pulled off a lot of victories that were in large part luck or just sheer audacity.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, California Senator Dianne Feinstein decides against running in the state's recall election.
Everyone's sort of wondering now that with Dianne Feinstein out whether that will cause a rush of Democrats to the ballot. I mean, right now there's 15 no-names. There's a cigarette retailer from Napa. There's a bounty hunter and a law school president. People like that, people no one's ever heard of.
Also, fresh fish and a 600-year-old fish market in Venice.
The inhabitants and the fish and the materials come from the land. And it's beautiful.
These stories coming up. Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. U.S. military helicopters have landed a 7-member Marine team in Liberia to aid West African peacekeepers. Nigerian troops arrived 3 days ago, and reporter Glenn McKenzie says the Nigerians may enter the capital city of Monrovia today.
So far, very few people in Monrovia have actually seen the Nigerians. They remain at the airport, which is about a 45-minute drive out of town. It's taken a while for news of the 6 to 10 American troops coming in to filter down to the street level in Monrovia. So far, there's been very little reaction to that, and most people are unsure what this means.
President Bush says he is sending the troops to clear the way for humanitarian relief. Conservative Episcopalians around the world say they may leave the church after yesterday's confirmation of an openly gay bishop, but the Reverend Gene Robinson says he'll do everything he can to heal wounds caused by his confirmation.
I'm certain there will be a few for whom this will be so troublesome that they cannot stay, but I will be doing everything that I can, and I believe the entire Episcopal Church will do everything it can to work with these folks and to find a way for us to live together.
Robinson spoke on NBC's Today Show. Some conservatives in the church have called on the Anglican bishop, Archbishop of Canterbury, to intervene. Police in Indonesia say they've seized documents showing terrorists were planning to target the area around Jakarta's Marriott Hotel. That's where a powerful car bomb this week killed at least 10 people and injured nearly 150. The documents were seized in a raid that netted 7 alleged members of an Islamic militant group accused of carrying out last year's Bali nightclub bombings. The U.S. military says Iraqi police have handed over the brother of one of Saddam Hussein's top bodyguards. The man was wanted for allegedly planning guerrilla attacks on American troops. A military spokesman also says soldiers have detained 18 loyalists of Saddam's regime. California Senator Dianne Feinstein says she will not run for governor in her state's recall election in October. The Democrat has decided against it, despite being the state's most popular politician. Actor Arnold Schwarzenegger will announce tonight whether he'll run as a Republican. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 52 points at 90.89. The Nasdaq is off 9 at 16.64. And the S&P 500 is up 4. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harrison for Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The California recall of Governor Gray Davis is becoming the topic of a lot of jokes lately, but there's an edge to the humor. In the words of late-night television host Jay Leno, if we didn't need a fair election to pick the president of the United States, we don't need a fair election to pick the governor of California. Well, jokes aside, the prospect of hanging chads and a conservative Supreme Court deciding yet another election is real in California, as are the half-dozen lawsuits seeking to stop the October 7th vote. And that's not all, folks. This morning, the Democrat seen as most likely to win, Senator Dianne Feinstein, said she would not put her name on the recall ballot. This after last night, the AFL-CIO asked Democrats to support Governor Davis. Well, joining us on the line is Dan Wood. He's Los Angeles Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
So, Senator Feinstein, not going to be in the race. What are the implications of that?
Well, it's a really big deal because she was one of the last shoes everyone's waiting to drop to hear about what she was going to do. So I think it's sort of bad for Democrats because they were sort of hoping she would get in. She's the only big name that they think could win. And it's good for Republicans because I think it clears the way for Richard Reardon, who's a moderate Republican.
And Dan, remind us who Reardon is.
Well, Reardon was the two-term Republican mayor of Los Angeles, and he's very popular. and he's sort of been given the blessing of the voters in the sense that they think he turned L.A. around during financial hard times.
Well, wouldn't it have been startling if Senator Feinstein had broken ranks with the Democratic Party and said that she would get on the ballot?
She didn't want to do it at all, but apparently I was just reading a biography of her. It was her big dream to be governor of California at some point. She just didn't want to do it under these circumstances. She hates the recall. She was recalled once herself as mayor in San Francisco, and she hated the whole idea of it. And she thinks it's a bad idea for California, and she's taking a stand, which I think is pretty interesting.
And what's the best guess at this point as to whether the Terminator, our actor Arnold Schwarzenegger, will in fact get into the race?
There are some people that think he might still do it, but everyone's been thinking for at least a week that he'll get out. He and Richard Reardon have sort of been talking about it and waiting for the right time for him to announce so that Reardon can announce that he'll be in.
Right, and apparently Arnold is going to announce something today.
Well, he's supposed to announce something today before going on Leno and then go on Leno to explain further. But it'll be a big surprise if he does say he's still in.
All right. Well, on the Today Show this morning, columnist Arianna Huffington said that she is going to run. She'll be an independent. Is she really a factor in this race?
Well, all the sources I've talked to say no. They think that she'll probably get less than 5% of the vote, and that won't be enough to win. So they don't consider her a factor.
Now, we should probably point out here, Dan, that even though nearly 500 people have taken out papers, so far only 15 have filed them and paid the fees. So there is a considerable gap between those two numbers.
Well, everyone's sort of wondering now that with Dianne Feinstein's out, whether that will cause a rush of Democrats to the ballot. I mean, right now there's 15 no names in it. You know, there's a cigarette retailer from Napa. There's a bounty hunter and a law school president, people like that, people no one's ever heard of. The only other big name that's been mentioned is Leon Panetta, who was a Clinton chief of staff and is considered to be a really good manager, but he doesn't seem to have a wide enough name recognition across the state.
And the California Supreme Court has been asked to rule on 5 lawsuits that are trying to stop the recall. Some of them are challenging the voting machines, the date, the qualification process. When are we likely to hear something from the court on those?
I've heard as early as Friday. There's 3 questions that I know of that could derail the recall. One is whether or not it's going to disenfranchise some of the voters, like you say, by putting poor and minorities in some of these places where there's not enough machines. The second one is that the method for choosing a successor is flawed. The Constitution says that the lieutenant governor should fill in if the governor is ousted.
And why does he seem to think that holding an election sometime in March is a better idea than doing it in October?
Well, special elections are smaller, and the March election will be a Democratic presidential primary and be a lot more Democrats in the race. That's the biggest reason.
Mm-hmm. And will it look bad, do you think, if the conservative court rules in favor of this Republican-backed recall?
I think there will be a lot of hypothesis in that regard. I haven't heard that will happen.
Wait and see on that one. Well, Dan Wood, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Dan Wood is Los Angeles Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
Well, the more the merrier, according to one candidate for California's potential recall vote. The LA Times says nearly 500 Californians have picked up filing papers. Imagine that ballot. It takes just 65 signatures and $3,500. That's not a problem for the man who funded the recall campaign, Representative Daryl Issa. He's expected to file papers today. Or Arnold Schwarzenegger, if he files. And then there's the Green Party candidate. Joining us on the line is Peter Camejo. He ran in last November's election and is going to run again, Peter?
Yes.
Why? With all the people out there, why are you entering what some people will say is a circus field?
Well, the Democrats are trying to hand over the governorship to the Republicans with their political suicide pact. They've agreed not to allow any alternatives because their corrupt and incompetent governor, if anybody enters, any Democrat enters, he's finished. That itself tells you something. And they have, you know, they have blood on their hands. What they have done in California is, and most, this is one of the greatest reasons the Greens are running, the basic facts are not out. We pay higher taxes. Poor people pay higher taxes in California than the rich.
Well, I know
nobody
that you,
knows that.
I know
nope.
that you're running on a platform because you are not funded by money or influenced by money, and you want to stop corruption in the utility industry as you perceive it, and you want teachers to get a better wage and living wage
right.
statewide in California. But still, do you think that message is going to rise above that of, the 26-year-old who's running because she has her name on her thongs, or the 99-cent store apparently is advertising anyone 99 years old, they will pay the filing fee and gather the signatures. And they're, you know, they're doing this obviously for advertising. How is your message going to get heard?
Well, we're already in first place in the polls in the Bay Area among independents, which is 21% of the population, among the liberals in California, which is 25% of the population, and among the poorest people. This is an amazing phenomenon for the Green Party to have risen so fast in the last 4 years in California. People are not paying attention. We beat the Republicans in the Inner Bay Area in the last elections. We have 65 people elected. We have the president of the supervisors of San Francisco. And right now, The Democrats are putting out that it was the economy that made this deficit. That's not true. We had the largest income in the history of California over the last 5 years, so much we should have a $30 billion surplus.
But just in the few seconds we have left, now have to get that message past Angeline, who is the large-busted woman who wears pink,
but I'm not sure what else she does. Humor, there's a lot of humor and entertainment going on about it, making fun of California, but there's something really serious going on here. The two parties have failed California. People are fed up. They're extremely angry at this governor. Every poll shows he'll be voted out, and people are focusing, the media like you are focusing on the humor and the comedy and the entertainment and not on the real issues that people are trying, like myself, to present about what the choices are in California. And I think Arianna Huffington and myself, we're going to form a bloc, and I think the first time we may have an independent governor in California. I'm at 11% among registered voters in California, and that's ahead of most of the people you're talking about, including the Republicans like Issa.
Well, Peter, we wish you the best of luck.
Okay, thank you.
Green Party candidate for governor of California, Peter Camejo. California,
yeah. You're listening to Here and Now.
How frozen is Alaska's tundra? Well, not as frozen as it used to be, apparently, and that's causing problems for companies that want to explore for oil there. State rules currently say that heavy oil exploration equipment can only be used when the ground is frozen 12 inches deep and covered by at least 6 inches of snow. Those rules are meant to protect the fragile tundra, and 30 years ago, those conditions prevailed for about 200 days a year. Now that number has been cut to last year's low of 103, presumably by global warming. The Energy Department says it's planning to study the tundra's resistance to disturbances, but critics say the study is a first step toward relaxing laws protecting the tundra. Well, joining us on the line is Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey, a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Thanks for joining us, Congressman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
How do you characterize this study?
I believe that the Bush administration is incapable of conducting an impartial study of drilling for oil in the Arctic. And I believe that they are in the process of producing a report that'll be nothing more than a rubber stamp for the oil and gas industry's desires to drill.
So, Congressman, you're concerned that, in fact, this study might give the administration a green light to go ahead with more oil exploration there?
Anything that, in my experience, has to do with the subject of oil in the Bush-Cheney era is going to wind up with a green light for development. They have consistently tried to bend or stretch the rules to make it possible to develop oil or natural gas, regardless of the consequences to the environment.
But if, in fact, the study shows that those consequences are quite severe, could it go the other way, that there will be enough attention paid to this that, in fact, the exploration will be limited?
Well, right now, unfortunately, the last group of people on the planet who deny that there is such a thing as global warming occupy the White House. So we should be prepared for them to come to a conclusion which minimizes the impact that they believe that global warming is having, and to try to find some way of accommodating the large footprints on the tundra of Alaska.
Mm. And what do you make of the fact that while this study is primarily funded by the Energy Department, there's another $70,000 of it that's coming from the oil companies?
Well, thus far, after the first 2.5 years of the Bush administration, there is very little to distinguish the energy industry from the energy department of the federal government.
Do you find this dramatic decrease in the number of days that the tundra is frozen sort of the canary in the coal mine? I mean, does this tell us something important and dramatic that we should be paying attention to?
What's happening in the Arctic is just a preview of coming attractions. This is just one more graphic example of how the Bush administration, rather than dealing with the reality of global warming, adjusts its anti-environmental policies so that it can continue to accommodate the drilling strategy of the oil and gas industry.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Good to talk to you again, Gail.
Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts is a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
At the break of dawn in Venice, Italy, shoppers arrive at the Rialto Fish Market to buy fresh, locally caught fish. For the past 600 years, the Rialto has been nestled along the Grand Canal. And that's just where we sent Here and Now's food guru, Scott Haas, to reel in some of the sounds.
I'm inside the Rialto Market. It's one of the most famous markets in the world. It's along the Grand Canal of Venice. And all around me, there are dozens of stalls. It's early in the morning. The fishermen have just delivered their shellfish and their fish. And the fish and shellfish are arrayed as if they are works of art. In front of me are gamberi from Sicily and giant scampi, coda di rospa, which is the name for monkfish, calamaretti, which are baby squid. I'm here with Luca. Luca, tell me, what is your full name?
Luca Di Vita.
And you're a restaurant owner in Venice, right?
Yes, right in the center of Venice.
What is the name of the restaurant?
Alle Testiere. Means to the headboards.
Because testa means head.
Yeah.
Alla Testiere means to the headboard, like of a bed?
Yes, the bed, which they're hanging on the wall. So we just took the name from them. We didn't know which name to give to the place.
I see. Now, why are we here? You come here each morning, or your chef comes here to buy fish and shellfish?
Yeah, the chef comes every morning to the market around 7:30.
I'm looking at that box of moving things. What is that?
These are manti shrimp, and these shrimp are, you know, like lagoon sandy shrimp, and that's why they move like that. You see the little, yeah?
The little fins almost.
Yeah, they walk a little bit like they walk on the sand, and they are local. For sure, because you find those only in the Adriatic and in Japan. The only two places in the world where you find it.
It's so strange, huh? And it's marvelous that they're moving, because this is unusual for most people in the United States when they buy their fish or shellfish, except for crab, it's dead.
You can see nothing is filet here.
That's
right. You don't find any filet like all over the world. Everything, you find the old fish, and they're still breathing. You know?
Yeah, the fish are still moving.
Yeah, and it's really beautiful.
Now, what are those? Those are beautiful.
John Dory is beautiful.
John Dory, the John Dory fish. With the, now, what is that? It's almost like a black dot on it.
Yes,
what is
this
that?
This is traditionally, that what they say is that the Saint Peter's,
Saint Peter, that's
took
a thumbprint.
That fish.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it stayed, you know.
It looks like a thumbprint.
That's it.
And so that's,
this is a thumbprint of St. Peter.
Oh, that's very beautiful. That's very, very beautiful.
So you know all these fish?
Of course. It's my work. but it's my life.
Did you always know this? I mean, have you always been working in restaurants?
No. Before I had... I was in hotel business.
Okay.
But I used to eat quite well. I mean, I liked fish and wine since ever, so... I used to come to the market by my, you know, for me and for my family. And
oh, so you're from Venice?
Yeah.
Okay. These are the polpette.
Calamari.
The baby ones you were talking about.
Yeah, the baby moscardini.
Moscardini, okay.
Yeah. And this is...
What did he just throw you?
He asked me if I still eat raw fish, and he threw me a piece of tuna. I know it's... You can taste it. It's a cute...
Oh, that's very nice.
It's part of the tuna, so we can have a little sushi.
Oh, that's very sweet. That's very sweet.
A little present in the market.
And these are the eels, the beautiful living eels, huh? So tell me something. There are here... We're standing here. There must be at least 24 fish mongers, fish stands... So how do you decide which ones to go? They all look beautiful to me.
You know, we have a couple of people that from who we take the fish since years. And we exactly know if something doesn't go. These people, they come to the restaurant, they pick the fish, and they take it back. You know, we know how to measure. They know how we work, so they know what to sell us.
So it's like everything. You have a relationship with
them. We have relations, and maybe sometimes... prices are better in other places, but the only thing you can do is just give a little confidence to them and work with them.
Wow, Luca has just taken me over to a fish stand with a French turbo, which is enormous. That must weigh, I don't know what. 58 kilo, maybe.
It's probably about 6 to 8 kilos.
6 to 8 kilos. That's beautiful, huh?
It's a huge animal.
It's a huge animal. It's I don't know how to. It's the size of an automobile tire. It's enormous. Now, who would buy this? Who would buy such a thing?
A restaurant, for sure.
A restaurant, okay.
A big restaurant, and maybe expecting a big table tonight.
So, in other words, a lot of these stands, they are selling to ordinary people like me, but they also depend a lot on restaurants, of course.
The first part of the day is for sure dedicated to the restaurateur. I mean, we are here, as you say,
ciao.
We are here at the from. 7:15, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and then we disappear. So what they say is that the real market is at that time, and then it's what is left.
Uh-huh. Well, it makes sense, because I couldn't. What would I do with this? Now, the waters are clean enough for all these fish?
The water is very clean and very rich of materials, eatable materials, and that's why we have a lot of fish here. I mean, if you go out with your boat and you put your how do you say that?
Your line out.
At least you get some gallinelle, which are those, some molly, which are the one.
The mullet, yeah.
Yeah. Or then you get those.
Those are beautiful.
Then you feel lucky, you get dorada, you like sea bass. You get sometimes turbot. Yes, this one also.
What are those? Those almost looks like a porgy.
Striped bream.
Striped bream, okay.
Yeah. And mormore. But then there is also a little tradition, the squid eggs.
Squid eggs?
You've seen that they're sold in the market.
Uh-huh.
And they are really the eggs of big squid, but that size. And
wow.
10 centimeters squid. They are thrown away in the rest of the world. We cook those, and we sell those as a very precious pearl in the appetizers, and we make it just boiled, very simple, with a little bay leaves and some vegetable. And these are...
Now, what is that? They say... What does that sign say over there?
Paganei. It's one of the other little fish that they live in the canals here.
But it says something about for risotto, or...?
There's no other way to eat those.
Oh, so people buy that, and the only reason you buy it is for risotto.
Very bondy, you know, as more bondy is the fish, as less costs.
Right.
And in this case, also, the taste is very small. But it's the tradition. You must have those in the market. You must have a case of it.
I understand.
Because you will find, you know, little lady coming around the 12:30, 1 o'clock, so and they will say, some. Yeah, and can I get some of these little things to make a simple risotto? You know, my pensione, it's very small. You know, everything, and, you know, I have to pay a lot for renting, and,
right.
You know.
I understand.
So you must have those.
That's very sweet.
Or for cats.
For cats. Of course, of course. You know what's fascinating about being here with you in the market is that so often when people come to Venice, they think of it as sort of a dead city, a city about the past and art and architecture. But being here in the market, you realize it's really a thriving community.
It is. It is alive, and you can see how still big is the, you know, the mixing, I don't know, between the city and the tradition and everything, and the inhabitants and the fish and the materials come from the land, and it's beautiful. Ma sento allegro stamattina, ieri tutta la rete mera, tanto pesci e
peschetta, e ma sento de criete. Here and now, resident foodie Scott Haas at the Rialto Fish Market in Venice, Italy. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Le peschette stamattina, lo venima con merchetta, e perché gli ne sfusam, corrite femmina d'olù paese, aiutate la bancarella, mettete la villa dentro la bunnella, dietro la frida della padella.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. at mathworks.com.